Our next case this morning is number 053968, Dutroux against the Chicago Housing Authority and the Central Advisory Council. To Whitfield, we'll wait a minute until the courtroom clears, please. Thank you, Mr. Whitfield. I think we can get underway now.
Please the court. Good morning. In the council. My name is Robert Whitfield, and I'm the attorney for the Central Advisory Council, which, from the briefs, is not a party to the matter, but intervened at the district court level.
Well, was there an intervention? If you had intervened, then you would be a party.
Well, there actually was not an intervention. Let me correct myself. We were given leave by the court to file a motion and actually had a hearing, and the judge issued a decision. It was.
What was the authority for the court to entertain your motion since you are not a party?
We assumed that it was in an order, which we cited in our brief, which gave the Central Advisory Council the right to participate if any subsequent revitalizing order affected the rights of our members, some 25,000 families who had a right to return.
Well, pursuant to what statute or rule or case was that order issued?
I don't think it was any statute cited. It was an agreed order that was entered. We went to the plaintiffs in the case. They agreed to it. They presented it. CHA agreed to it, and the judge entered it. I don't think it was ever briefed or opposed. It was at the time when the relocation rights contract, which was the heart of the 10-year plan for transformation, had just been finalized, and we wanted to make sure.
Your members are otherwise represented in the litigation, are they not?
Some of our members are. The CAC represents all public housing residents throughout the city of Chicago.
I see.
Senior housing residents are not members of the controlled class. Family housing members are, but we do not represent people on the waiting list who are also controlled class members.
Have you participated in other phases of this litigation?
No, the Central Advisory Council has not been before the court, the district court, or this court, and in any litigation that I'm aware of.
In this litigation, have you?
No, we have not.
You haven't been before the district court at other phases of the remedial process?
No, we have not, Your Honor.
So I gather then from your response is that this order that you alluded to was entered without any legal authority and was just sort of done by agreement of everyone, but not pursuant to any legal authority. So would we be correct in concluding that what occurred in the district court is completely void?
Well, that's obviously...
we have to get to the issue of standing to appeal, too.
Right.
But I'm just addressing this threshold question about the legitimacy of what went on in the lower court. I don't see any legal authority for it.
Well,
If you can cite me some, I'd be happy to listen.
Well,
I don't know that
Your Honor, when we filed a motion, I mean, we did not treat it as a motion to intervene, and had the court directed us to do that, actually file a formal motion to intervene, we would have done so.
Were there any grounds for intervention at this stage of the proceeding?
I think we would have relied on the Supreme Court cases cited in all of the briefs, the Dublin case, because... three-fourths of our members are unnamed class members, and the Devon case, at least in my opinion, seems to hold that unnamed class members have a right to intervene. And I think the Seventh Circuit in the case I cited in the brief has said that intervention is not necessary in order to participate in the appeal.
But that's where unnamed class members are actually the parties seeking to litigate, and CAC is not an unnamed class member.
It is comprised of the 23 presidents who make up the CAC. 20 are elected representatives who are themselves class members, who were elected by residents who are themselves class members.
Right.
I could have named each of those presidents who would have been class members, but it, you know, since no one raised it, it just seemed like a formality without a difference, distinction without a difference.
Why did you? What really did you have to? When you made a decision to enter the litigation, to come before the district court, why were you in a particularly unique position to present a perspective not available from the present litigants?
Well, the relocation rights contract speaks only to current residents, not to residents on the waiting list, who are also control class members. It gives those residents priority, and that's one of the requirements that HUD imposed as a condition for approving this 10-year, $1.6 billion plan for transformation, that lease amendment is legally binding on CHA and gives priority to our class members. We learned that once this housing started being built and new units didn't come online until 2005, almost 9 years after this June 1996 order was entered, and once they started renting, CHA realized, and we realized because we monitored the situation, that there weren't enough control class members, either current residents or people on the waiting list, who fit this 50 to 80% requirement. Half of these 150 units had to be filled by people whose income was 50 to 80%. So we suggested, once we heard that the developer, who was also in the management company, wanted to create a site-based waiting list and go outside, let's modify the 50 to 80%. The plaintiffs were agreed and, in fact, submitted the order. CHA said they could live with either proposal, and so it was presented before the judge. And so here you have this unusual situation where the party opposing it is the court's receiver, who was appointed to oversee the development program, and they're the appellees and we're the appellant. Neither of us are actual parties to the litigation.
Weren't you very much like an amicus to the district court then? You had a perspective. You could see an impact from the remedial order that the district court perhaps would not be made fully aware of by the parties, and you wanted to make the court aware of that. Isn't that basically what you wanted to do?
We did, but we wanted to do more than that. As I said before, had the court required it, we would have filed a formal motion to intervene to oppose going outside the waiting list, which was something which we considered extraordinary. And, in fact, plaintiff's counsel agreed with us because for the first time in the history of this case, which has been going on almost 40 years, relief is being provided as a priority over class members, and that had never been done before. Now, not all the class members we represent. Obviously, we don't represent the 35,000 people on the waiting list, but we do represent the 25,000 people who are in occupancy and also control class members. So we wanted to do more than just bring it to the court's attention. We wanted to modify the 50 to 80% requirement so that our members would not be affected by this and, for all practical purposes, precluded from living on the lakefront in these units.
I mean, you can't do that as a non-party, though. I mean, in order to make an application for relief, you have to be a party. You were never made a party. You assert here that you represent the interests of some of the class members, but the class members, as Judge Ripple inquired about at the outset of this argument, are already represented, and so you would not have had grounds to intervene to represent a subset of the class members, I don't think, unless you've got an argument on that point, but I haven't heard it yet.
Well, I would say that there is a potential conflict between our subclass of current residents and the subclass of people on the waiting list. The priority under the relocation rights contract, which is a lease amendment, gives priority for all of the current residents who are in occupancy as of 10/1/99. The people on the waiting list take secondary priority. To the extent that there were not enough people to fill the 50 to 80 among the current residents, CHA would then go to the waiting list, which would violate the relocation rights contract, and a conflict would arise. But we, the CAC, did not want to be in a position of saying the people on the waiting list who are also control class members, even though they're taking in violation of the relocation rights contract priority for our resident, should not do that. So we went and talked to the plaintiffs and said, we'll accept that, but we will not accept going outside the waiting list and bypassing our subclass and your subclass. But yes, I believe there is a potential conflict, and if, you know, if we have to do it all over again, we will file a motion to intervene that there is a potential conflict between that class and our class, which I guess would give us standing to once again appear before us. But to me, it seems to be a difference without a distinction. That's just my humble opinion.
Would you be the individuals who are members, would they be third-party beneficiaries? I assume this 1996 order is still a consent decree, is it not? Is that what we're talking about?
The 1996 order was a revitalizing order which allowed for the building of public housing units in that area.
But I mean, that's where we get into these two categories, right?
Right.
That would establish it. Because I'm just looking at maybe one, the individual members could be third-party beneficiaries and then maybe have some capacity to go forward. But I don't see where CAC is. CAC is not a third-party beneficiary. Now, that's a different concept. It may have standing, but not the capacity to challenge it.
Had I named the individual presidents, would be those third-party beneficiaries. In fact, the chairperson of the CAC is the president of the Washington Park LAC and has a direct interest because Lake Park Crescent Development is, in fact, within the jurisdiction.
But CAC is the only entity we're dealing with here.
Yes, it is.
Yeah, that may be the problem, at least the way I see it. As far as the merits, I mean, you can do what you want with those, too.
Well, going to the merits, leaving the standing issue for a brief moment, one of the things that brought us to the court is we filed a motion to modify that order. Plaintiffs agreed with us. CHA said they could live either with our modification or the on-site waiting list where people would be recruited from outside. And the district court denied our motion to modify, saying that, and I quote their language, they see no extraordinary change since 1996 that would justify a change. I mean, in our opinion, that language itself is extraordinary. Of course there's been a change. Otherwise, we wouldn't be before the court. Had we not filed a motion, something would have been done, or else you would be faced with the prospect that 75 units would be vacant because there were not enough people on the waiting list to qualify. There were not enough current residents to qualify. Of the 35,000 people on the waiting list, less than 0.7% qualified for this 50 to 80%. That means 99% of the people on the waiting list would have been precluded. Of our tenants, over 93% would have been precluded. That's not some slight delay as represented in the appellee's brief. That's exclusion altogether. Now, I don't know what Webster's definition of extraordinary is, but that sounds like an extraordinary change to me. Either the district court would have not modified the order, which meant that CHA could not rent these units, and they would be vacant. Now, they didn't modify the order, but they might as well have. They then issued an order the same day allowing site-based waiting lists. Had they not done that, then these new, brand-new units would still be vacant. I think that is a pretty extraordinary change, and it did require something. And the court to say nothing happened just ignores the fact. It also ignores what plaintiff's counsel for the control class said. He did not just say that he found merit in both positions. He did say that. But in the transcript, he clearly says that on balance, he opposes the site-based waiting list and would favor and support eliminating the 50 to 80% requirement. Now, one other thing the court ignored, a HUD spokesman testified at the hearing and came up with what we feel and we adopted in our brief was a very reasonable approach. Not eliminating it, the priority would still be there, but if there weren't enough people in that category, the 50 to 80, HUD proposed going to the 35 or 40 to 50 or 35 to 40. And in fact, based that recommendation on the fact that she had talked with CHA people who said if it was lowered to that, there would be more than enough people to fill these 50 to 80 units. It seems to me completely arbitrary if you have a standard so rigid that says if you're making 48% of medium income, you're not qualified to live here. I mean, you know, what is that all about? It sounds like a slippery slope back to what created Gautreaux in the first place. A neighborhood saying, we don't want anybody here who can't make above a certain level. It is not the race claim, obviously, that brought Gautreaux here, but it certainly is very arbitrary. There was no testimony given as to why someone who's making 48 or 45% of medium income is not qualified or is somehow going to lower the standards and lead to this being, you know, some all-concentrated low-income place. There's no testimony to that. The other thing that occurred that wasn't there in 1996 is elimination of all of the public housing high-rises, or most of them, around there. As we speak today, very few are there. And that's happening all around the city, not just there. As Gautreaux plaintiff's counsel pointed out, that's a huge difference.
Mr. Whitfield, your time has expired.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, sir. We'll hear now from Mr. Felton.
May it please the Court, Edward Feldman on behalf of the receiver. I had planned on focusing on the abuse of discretion standard and talking to the Court about how this case is quintessentially an abuse of discretion case and that standard really decides the case. But since the Court expressed in its questions to Mr. Whitfield interest in the party question, I thought I would address that.
Has this sort of thing been going on routinely in this litigation where non-parties are permitted to parachute in and ask the court for relief, and the court entertains it, and the parties
don't object, routinely.
And everybody sings kumbaya and lets things go on in this way? This seems to me to be highly unorthodox.
It hasn't routinely happened that way. If I can try to
I'm asking
elaborate.
For some historical perspective, yes. Since I don't have it.
As I understand it from the history of the case, usually when the court, well, it's occurred in several instances. In some instances, tenants or other groups have sought intervention in the case formally through a motion. Sometimes that has been permitted. Sometimes that has been denied.
Post-judgment?
Yes. For purposes of making a claim or an argument with respect to a particular remedial order that might be entered. As an example, if we take Cabrini Green, there was a dispute over whether a consent decree should be entered in that case, in the case of Cabrini Green and the revitalization and the rebuilding at Cabrini Green. This was back in the late 90s. And the local advisory council for the Cabrini Green tenants sought leave to intervene for the limited purpose of objecting to certain events that were happening, and that intervention motion was granted for that limited purpose. So, and then there's another instance with respect to the ABLA homes on the Near West side, where a dissident group of tenants sought to intervene to attack, similar to what has happened here, sought leave to intervene to object to a revitalizing order that had been entered. And Judge Aspin denied that intervention motion. The judge thought that they were adequately represented by the class counsel in the case, and therefore they did not have a right to intervene under Rule 24A, and he denied permissive intervention as well. That went up on appeal, and then the appeal got dismissed voluntarily.
Why weren't those procedures insisted upon here?
I was going to describe like a third context.
Okay, fine.
Okay.
Go ahead.
And I think that will answer.
Okay.
In some instances, one of the parties would come forward with some sort of motion. So it could be the plaintiffs, the CHA, or some sort of joint motion asking for some relief. And from time to time, the court has permitted non-parties to come in without a formal intervention motion, but simply to comment much as you might happen in a fairness hearing and a class action settlement where objections or comments might be heard from class members.
That's not that rare in institutional remedial orders in federal court.
Pardon me?
That's not that rare in institutional remedial
orders. I don't think it is. And I think what distinguishes this case from that situation where interested parties, and in this case it's been sometimes class members who are disagreeing with something class counsel is recommending, or sometimes community leaders who are upset about some order that might affect the development of housing in their community.
They don't give them the right to appeal.
That does not give them, and that's the question raised by the Devlin case, which we raised in our brief. Mm-hmm. A class member under the Devlin case may have a right to appeal. At least they did under the facts of that case, which involved class members objecting to a fairness in a context of a fairness hearing. But here, as a technical matter, it is not the class members; it is the incorporated entity that has. In the district court, quite frankly, I don't think anybody focused on the formality of the corporate entity at that point. It didn't get on our radar screen until we looked at the appellate jurisdiction issue.
There is a class representative in this whole thing.
Oh, absolutely.
So there'd have to be some kind of an inquiry as to whether or not that class representative was in a position to make the case that needed to be made, represent everyone in his class, or whether or not an adversarial relationship had grown up within the class.
And,
right?
And the class representative here, Mr.
Really
Polakoff, counsel for the class, did not file a formal motion in district court seeking the relief that the CAC sought.
So we've got a lot of. So before intervention of these individuals, this group could never be permitted. The district court had to ask quite a few questions that were never asked.
I'm not sure I follow your question.
Well, if the district court wanted the CAC to file a motion to intervene, the district court would have had to pursue these issues of the capacity of the class representative to represent the class, or whether or not there was an antagonistic relationship between the CAC and other members of the class. Right?
If there were, certainly under Rule 24A, the adequacy of representation is one of the elements, and that's precisely the reason that with the ABLA development, I think it's back in 2000, he denied intervention
in
that instance.
So given the equitable remedy that he had to deal with here, apparently the district court simply said his, or in effect said he was going to listen to these people as amici and find out what they had to say about the impact of what of the choices he had before him and move on.
I believe that your analogy to the amicus is a good one, with the caveat that amici usually don't file motions other than a motion to appear as an amici and comment to.
Well, and that's an important distinction, I think, and takes this case outside of that third category that you mentioned as somehow providing some explanation or context for what went on here. This was not a case where the parties were making an application for relief and the judge was permitting an interested non-party to comment. This is a case where the non-party is actually making the application for relief and the parties are just sort of going along with it.
That's true, but to be fair to Mr. Whitfield, CHA was going to file a motion with respect to the site-based waiting list, and they sort of beat CHA to the courthouse on that. The issue was probably going to be presented, so the timing of it, they went first, but the issue was being discussed.
Well, this is not just a matter of timing, though. This goes to the court's power and authority to do what it did, and it apparently had no legal authority to entertain this motion, this application for relief from a non-party.
And so
it did is completely void.
Well,
apart from the standing to appeal issue, which is also important.
I don't think what the court did was void, because the court denied their relief.
Really?
So what the court did
should
is
not
left
have entertained it.
That's a different question. But the court left intact the June 3, 1996 order and entered an additional order that CHA, a party, presented to the court, and that was argued. And the parties, the actual parties and the receiver commented on that proposed order. It was part of the hearing that was held last July. So that issue was properly teed up by the parties.
But the fact that the status quo was not effectively altered by virtue of the unorthodox procedure here hardly makes the procedure orthodox.
I don't disagree with that.
Okay.
You don't?
Pardon?
I mean, you, in other words, this is not done in
it's not
on a regular basis?
Orthodox, but I think that the proceeding in the nature of an amicus and hearing what interested class members have to say on an issue is not inappropriate. The question that Mr. Whitfield made this argument, and it's in his brief as well, he referred to an order that had been entered earlier in 2000, and Judge Sykes asked about whether that order was entered with authority. And the order is in A6 of the appendix, and it's an order that was entered in 2000, and they're purporting to proceed under that order. The terms of the order, whether the order was validly entered or not, do not apply. That order contemplated the situation that I described, that if a party were coming in and presenting a new revitalizing order or seeking to change a revitalizing order, that order provided by agreement of the parties that the CAC could come in and comment upon that and be heard. So that was an agreement which I think is appropriate, is within the broad range of orthodoxy for class action remedial processes, to permit class members, putting aside the corporate label umbrella on this particular group of class members, but permitting class members to comment upon proposed remedial orders that are presented by the parties to the court. That's what that order at page A6 talks about. It did not authorize this particular procedure of them coming in and filing their own motion. But nobody, it's correct that nobody objected to the process in the district court the way it
unfolded. But they can't appeal.
Pardon?
They can't appeal.
Whether they can appeal depends on whether, under the Devlin case,
they're not
technically a
they're
party.
They're not a third-party beneficiary. They can't even challenge the order.
The corporate entity is not has standing in that sense. I'll just take a couple of minutes to comment on, if the court does reach the merits, the abuse of discretion standard. In this area of remedial, the remedial phase of a lawsuit, the abuse of discretion standard is perhaps at its apex. At pages 26 and 27 of our brief, we set forth many cases from institutional class litigation context. One of the Seventh Circuit cases we cited, the 1999 edition of the People Who Care litigation. Judge Posner wrote that this was a quintessentially judgmental type of area where there's no alternative for the court but to defer broadly to the district court. And this district judge has presided over the Gautreaux litigation for approximately 25 years. He's been very hands-on, has intimate knowledge of the case. And he was presented with two rational alternatives to solve a problem. The problem was that there were, at the time the argument was presented to him, there were 15 vacancies in this 50 to 80% class of units, and there were two approaches to how to solve that problem. He heard from both sides. Most significantly, he heard from the court-appointed receiver, a real estate development expert and professional, and he was quite within the very broad discretion accorded to him to decide that, at least without prejudice for these first group of units, to stick with the status quo, keep the 50 to 80% provision intact, and allow the creation of a site-based waiting list that, if they could not find qualified tenants from within CHA or from within the CHA waiting list, then they could go to the site-based waiting list and fill whatever handful of vacancies would remain. The receiver described in great detail, and it's set forth in the brief, the very extensive community building and process that occurred preceding 1996, where the community was very hostile to any public housing being rebuilt. They had very bad experiences with the old public housing there. They were very hostile, and a very delicate compromise and balance was reached with the community, and to go back on that agreement would have cost the receiver credibility, the community leader's credibility, and ultimately the court credibility. And Judge Aspin took a modest step to address the question, and he in no way abused his discretion. And not once in the briefs, does Mr. Whitfield tackle the other side of the story. With that, we ask that the court affirm. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Feldman. Mr. Johnson.
May it please the court, Tom Johnson on behalf of the Chicago Housing Authority. I only have 2 minutes. Let me make just a couple of quick points. We agree with the receiver on the appellate jurisdiction point. We don't believe there's authority for a non-party to be present here, particularly where class counsel chose not to appeal this controversy up to the court. With respect to the merits, I just want to underscore that these 30 units at Lake Park Crescent are a small part of the 25,000 units that we are currently engaged in redeveloping and rehabilitating at many sites around the city. They presented a very practical problem with this 50 to 80% income tier. In fact, because these are tax credit financed units, we had to look for people between 50 and 60% of AMI. The tax credit rules place a 60% ceiling on occupancy. So we were looking for people making about $33,000 to $38,000 a year to fill these units. We were delivered the units, or we finished the units in November of 2004. Shortly after that, we had completed the task, the time-consuming task, of going through all of the families that had been displaced from the lakefront high-rises, all of the families and the rest of CHA that had said they had an interest in living at the lakefront, and then all of the families living in any CHA facility in any part of the city saying, do you qualify? At that point, we had six of the 30 units leased up. We then spent a considerable amount of time with all the stakeholders involved in this trying to come up with a plan B. By July, when this hearing took place, these units had sat, actually by July, we had leased, by going through the waiting list, about half the units, but we still had 15 that were vacant, and they had been vacant for 8 months. There are problems with vacant units, part of which have to do with vandalism and such, but part of which have to do with the developer, who is under very strict occupancy deadlines. The developer is being fined under the tax credit scheme if they don't lease up those units. So there was tremendous pressure to find Plan B, whatever Plan B was. One Plan B is the site-based waiting list where we go out to people who are not at CHA, not on the waiting list, who are income eligible. The other Plan B on the table was Mr. Whitfield's plan of dropping the 50% requirement. Both are legal. And so I just would implore you that this is a tough job to do this redevelopment, and Judge Aspin has exercised his flexibility or his discretion in a very flexible way, and we would hope that the court would not disturb that.
Thank you, Mr. Whitfield. I'm sorry, Mr. Johnson. Mr. Whitfield, your time had expired, but if you have something you'd like to say, I certainly will give you a minute to do that.
I just want to address one point that was made, that it is true there is development going on throughout the city, but unfortunately, Lake Park Crescent and just a few others are some of the few places where we can reasonably expect that they will be integrated. Places at Allgaier, Wentworth Gardens, the State Street Quarter are also having new or completely rehabbed housing, but I don't think anyone's under any illusion that any integration is going to come there anytime soon. So the Lake Park Crescent represents one of the few developments, one of the few places where there will be integrated units, which was one of the whole purposes of releasing the control case in the first place. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Whitfield, and thanks to all counsel in the case, and it will be taken under advisement.